It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The 57th Carnegie International opens tomorrow at the Carnegie Museum of Art, featuring 32 artists and collectives. We're pleased to be joined in studio by the curator of the Carnegie International, Ingrid Schaffner. Ingrid, welcome to the confluence.
Thank you.
All right. Opening night jitters yet? Not going to happen?
I know what I'm wearing. And I know that there's a fabulous exhibition to open the doors and celebrate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how that exhibition came about. It is the second oldest international exhibit of contemporary art in the world.
Yeah.
Something to be proud of. And I don't know if Pittsburgh takes as much pride as it should in that.
Well, I know that for my colleagues around the world, the Carnegie International is renowned and people will flock to Pittsburgh to see this exhibition. And yes, maybe it is less recognized locally, but people know and remember extraordinary things that they've seen because of a Carnegie International.
All right. From a professional point of view, how big of a plum is being the curator of the Carnegie International?
It is not a plum. It is a pineapple.
Ooh, that's a big one.
Yeah. Richard Armstrong, organizer of the 1995 International, became the director of the Carnegie Museum. And so people go on to do great things from this important exhibition.
So I believe for about 15 years, you directed the exhibition program at the Institute of Contemporary Art.
At the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, yes.
So how has your past experience, including that, and your curating of other exhibits, how did that inform your approach to the Carnegie International?
So I am an exhibition maker, and I am out in the world looking at contemporary art all the time and working with and thinking with my artist peers. So to come here and apply that to this big show was a natural.
When you accepted the post a little more than 3 years ago now, right? Were you given any charge, any direction? They said, or did they just say, Ingrid, go to it?
To do the Carnegie International, it's like you build an institution within the institution. You're really given a lot of freedom. You build your own team and you make your own show with your own publication program. And yes, you're given a lot of latitude and freedom.
Okay. I'm not going to ask you every single home base of these artists. But give us a sense of the traveling that is involved over what sort of period of time leading up to actually what we're going to see.
So 2016 was my concerted year of travel. I visited 21 different countries and I think there's 24 nations represented by the artists, either by birth or by affiliation, where they live today in the exhibition. So, yeah, I covered a wide swath of territory, but of course it's just a little fraction of the world.
I mean, you have the knowledge, but what's your baseline? Where do you start and say, well, I want to check them out. I want to reinforce my initial impressions. Or what is your approach to traveling and visiting and, again, seeing work that they have already done or talking to them about work that they will do specifically for the international?
Well, it's all of that, just as you said. So some of the artists are artists that I've worked with before and we're sort of, continuing a working relationship. Other artists new to me, Pittsburgh's new to them. This is, then they're building something new and fresh. But, I have to say that everyone is really stepping it up for this exhibition. People are really inspired by both the history of the show, but by the museum itself. The museum is a museum of museums, and it's a very inspiring material for artists to work with. And you'll feel that in the exhibition, how works were made for this, for us.
Well, you mentioned before an institution within an institution, but now you said a museum of museums because of Museum of Art, Museum of Natural History.
And there's the art museum, this great modernist building attached to this great neoclassical building. So, it's also all these architectures and the Hall of Sculpture, the miniature period room. To be in our museum is to go into worlds within worlds.
Okay. You did, and I don't know if this is unusual or not. Tell me, that you wanted the artist to come to Pittsburgh. Mm. Why did you want that? And is it unusual, do you know, from past curators?
No, that's very much of the contemporary. We're working with living artists, after all.
Right.
They are of the world, of our world. So, to have artists come and get a sense of the place and the context. So 2016 was my year of travel, and then 2017 was the year of inviting artists to come to Pittsburgh. And really, it was an open invitation to see, do you want to do this thing together? And everybody who came said yes. But it was also a chance to explore the city with artists and deepen my understanding of the context for the show.
Now, that exploration, was it as much as, yes, I want to be part of this, or if they were doing specific work for the exhibit to get some sort of inspiration?
Both. And it happened a number of times where I'd be talking to an artist about doing one thing, and then when they came and they were in Pittsburgh, they were catalyzed to do something truly responsive to the place. So.
Right. How much of the exhibit is work that was already in existence, and how much was it newly created for this?
Really, by and large, newly created.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So this doesn't happen all the time, does it, that Pittsburgh artists are included? Did you go intentionally say, I want Pittsburgh, or I want to make sure I give full, you know, attention to them to see if we want to include some Pittsburgh artists?
Pittsburgh artists have been consistently represented in the Carnegie International.
Okay.
Even in the last International Transformasium, participated as but for me, the idea of the international as not something that's far away that you bring to Pittsburgh. No, Pittsburgh is an international city. We are international. We are global. And so to identify Pittsburgh in terms of the creative artists who live and work here and who are living and working on a national to international stage. That was the
right.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. It goes back to what I said. Mm-hmm. You know, do Pittsburghers, and I'm a native, do we appreciate what we have as much as maybe some folks out of state, out of country do? Of course, the Carnegie Museum, but also the Warhol. I mean, I think a lot of people just know Pittsburgh because of our great cultural assets.
And there is so much local Pittsburgh pride for our museums.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe I underestimate it.
No.
Okay. Now, what did you want to include from the Pittsburgh artists? So what touched you and say, yeah, that I want that in this exhibit?
So Thaddeus Mosley, our great local sculptor, Thaddeus Mosley, a studio visit with him early on. Thaddeus said that he learned his avocation as an artist through the Carnegie International in 1958, seeing the work of Isamu Noguchi inspired him to become the sculptor that he is today. So to connect to that history and story through including Thaddeus's work in the exhibition. And another great Pittsburgh artist is Mel Bochner, who born in Pittsburgh, raised in Pittsburgh, learned to draw at the Carnegie Museum of Art as a tam o' shanter in the free art classes for children, went to Carnegie Institute, and is one of the leading figures of contemporary conceptual art working today. So absolutely, Mel Bochner in the Carnegie International.
Oh, right. I did not ask you about a theme for this exhibit. Is there an overarching theme? And the use of multimedia, how do they all come together if there is a theme?
There wasn't a theme in as much as I didn't go off, you know, looking to find work that illustrated or reflected a theme.
Right.
But themes emerge because artists are in and of the world and they bring the world to the museum. And so pressingly, urgently, there's the theme of the international, a word that really changed its meaning in the 3 years that I worked on this show.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning, international sounded a little quaint, you know, oh, we're in a global art world. But, you know, increasingly the pressure on nations, borders, this kind of gives a ready-made urgency to the international, thinking about the meaning of that word for us today in the world.
Okay. We have just a couple minutes left, unfortunately. I mentioned the tradition, second oldest in the world for contemporary art, of an international exhibit. Is there any reference, acknowledgement, even homage to past Carnegie Internationals?
Oh, my goodness. Well, John Rubin and Lenka Clayton, two artists who are based here in Pittsburgh, collaborated on a work. One of the first things you'll experience is they've transformed a gallery into a painting studio, painting factory, two people painting text-based works. And what are the texts? They are rejected titles from past Carnegie Internationals. So paintings that were submitted for inclusion, but were rejected for one reason or the other. John and Lenka collected all of those titles, all 10,632 of them, and the titles are being transformed into paintings on paper, which visitors will be able to take one home if you were lucky enough to get one. So, yes, we're kind of gestating a history of the Carnegie International through the process of, or through the duration of the show.
Okay, in our remaining 30 seconds or so, because art is meant to be shared, what specifically do you want to share regarding and through the Carnegie International?
Museum joy. You know, it's a pleasure to be in a museum with art and other people doing the creative work of interpretation. So come experience that joy with the Carnegie International.
And even if you can't come on opening weekend,
you have until March 25th, 2019. Yes.
Very good.
Yeah.
Ingrid Schaffner is a writer, art critic, educator, and she's the curator of the 57th Carnegie International, which opens to the public Saturday at the Carnegie Museum of Art. Ingrid, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Pittsburgh jazz pianist Johnny Costa dies at the age of 74 in 1996. Locally, Costa was best known for his work on the beloved children's show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. He was born in Arnold, Pennsylvania, and he had perfect pitch. A graduate of Carnegie Mellon University, Costa played piano and organ for radio stations before landing the job with WQED and Mr. Rogers. He served in that role from the show's debut in 1968 until his death. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac for October 10th, 2018.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up in just a minute, we're going to talk about the week with nonviolence. But first, we're going to get an update from Chris Potter, WESA's editor for our Government Accountability and Politics team. Chris, you're reporting that the executive director of the Allegheny County Democratic Committee has resigned just weeks after being appointed to the post. Why has Mark Selvis resigned?
He stepped down yesterday as there was a growing controversy about some social media posts that he and his wife had put up over those past several months on Facebook. He had posted on his page some criticism of black athletes not standing for the national anthem. And his wife had posted an appeal to people to help pay for the legal defense fund for Officer Michael Rosfeld, who's apparently a family friend of hers and was the office of the East Pittsburgh officer who shot Antoine Rose in June.
Yeah. So the executive director of the committee does not have a role in policy making per se, but it's not a good look, especially we're only 4 weeks away from the election.
Yeah, that's correct. This is mainly sort of a glorified office manager type position. His main job is to sort of do administrative and clerical work to support the chair, Eileen Kelly. As you say, it's right before the election. The party still says we're going to be turning voters out. And I think part of the concern here is there were a lot of activists talking about this on social media. You want to turn those folks out. You want to turn out your black vote, especially. And there were a lot of concerns coming from black elected officials about kind of what message was being sent here.
Turn out, not turn off.
Yeah, exactly so. Very nice.
Okay. Any impact, positive, little bump for Republicans, or not too hard to say?
It's hard to say. Most people don't know, even who are regular committee, regular Democrats don't know who the executive director of their party is. I think it's obviously the party moved very quickly to kind of nip this in the bud precisely because they didn't want to depress and demoralize their own voters.
WESA's Chris Potter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. This coming Sunday through the following Sunday, the local chapter of Black Women for Positive Change will host the annual Week of Nonviolence as part of the ongoing effort to change the culture of violence in Pittsburgh, across the country, and even in the UK. We're pleased to be joined in studio by Diane Powell, president of Black Women for Positive Change, the Pittsburgh chapter. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you, Kevin. Good morning.
And Mickey McDonough, who is with Moms Demand Action. Good to have you with us, Mickey.
Thank you.
All right. This is the sixth annual Week of Nonviolence. So how are you making a difference?
We're making a difference in terms of our commitment and willingness to challenge cultural norms in our country that people have become complacent with. Too often we become desensitized to violence, to the concepts that are glorified in movies and on TV. And we're working to try to make a cultural shift and to make more people aware that there are alternatives to violence, that there's conflict resolution, there's mediation, but just to really make a shift. And our country has demonstrated in the past that although change is difficult and it's not easy, it's a slow process, that change can indeed occur. As evidenced during the Civil Rights Movement, when the gains that African Americans made as a result of cultural shifts that occurred in our country. More recently, it occurred with the LGBTQ community, with the advances that they made with their civil rights. So change is possible, and that's what we're working towards.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Moms Demand Action partners with Black Women for Positive Change on the levels that Diane has just mentioned. But Diane, you kind of intimated that some of these changes have been legislative.
Definitely.
And policy changes.
Definitely.
So I think I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Moms Demand Action has really worked for years trying to get legislation passed that would remove guns from domestic abusers.
Yes, House Bill 2060.
Exactly, House Bill 2060, which was passed, well, it was passed actually in the spring by the Senate, then it went to the House and back and forth, but it was finally passed over a week ago in the Senate and has been signed by Governor Wolf.
And that, of course, would make abusers surrender their guns much more quickly than they had to.
Yes.
And to more appropriate authorities.
Yes, within 24 hours, and not to a family or a friend, but to an authorized gun dealer, law enforcement, or their attorneys.
Mm-hmm. Not to shock, but to point out the situation, this year, to this point, the number of homicides are trending about the same as in 2017. But there have been 37 homicide victims between 21 and 30 years old, but 90% of them are African American. What does that tell you about the overall issue of violence in our communities?
I think a lot of the problems that are happening in the African American community do relate to illegal gun sales and black straw.
Proliferation of guns.
For sure.
Right,
that are available in African American communities. And Mickey and I have talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've encouraged her in Moms Demand Action to consider legislation to help eliminate that pipeline of
right.
weapons into our communities.
All right.
That,
the name of your organization, For Positive Change, how do you remain positive, though, when you hear such numbers, as I just mentioned, 21 to 30-year-olds and 90% of the victims are African American? How do you remain positive, Diane?
It's a staggering statistic, that one that it's endemic to the entire country, not just in Pittsburgh. But there are hundreds of individuals and organizations who are working tirelessly to turn the tide. And we gain hope and feel positive because of the connections that we've made with young people. We've hosted contests. We've engaged them in local schools where they have led initiatives within their schools to help combat violence and to work with their peers to have a more peaceful and safe school environment. And the feedback that we receive from those young people, it's been very encouraging. And it warms our heart to see them step up to become politically engaged, to actually go to Harrisburg and speak with state Wow. legislators, mm-hmm. but to recognize that the answer and the solution ultimately will lie with them.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we have a couple organizations represented right here in the studio. So how do you sort of reach out? How do you integrate a variety of people, a variety of organizations focused on one goal? Mickey, let's start with
you. Yeah, well, MOMS is grassroots advocacy organization, all volunteers. So we've done things, for example, Wear Orange Day, and which Black Women for Positive Change collaborated with us. We were in Market Square for several hours early in June and really attracted people to come to our tables, to get information about how to reduce gun violence, how to encourage gun safety, even things such as, hey, is there a gun in your home? Are you storing it properly so children and adolescents who might be thinking about committing suicide, so they don't have easy access to those weapons. So that's, you know, we're visible. We wear red shirts. You can see us everywhere.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Diane, I wanted to ask you, you sure. held an event leading up to this week asking how churches should be responding to families impacted by violence. What was the message given to our religious leaders and our communities, and how did they respond?
We had an extremely large turnout at Rodman Street Baptist Church in East Liberty, and the focus of the workshop was on moms who have lost children to violence. And we featured two individuals who have lost children. One, Luanna Coward, lost three sons to violence. Winona Harper lost a son and a nephew. But somehow, through their courage, their faith in God, and strength and character, they were able to walk through that pain and come out on the other side. And they are now ministering to young women and to homeless children who are just pretty much out there in society without an anchor. And they have worked actively to try to rescue and support those young people and to make sure that they complete high school education and to become active members of our society. The dialogue at the workshop was very, very robust. We received candid feedback from other young mothers.
I believe one of them said, don't wait until it comes to your doorstep before you stand up against violence. That message could be delivered anywhere, whether it was to a church, a school, anybody's individual home.
Exactly. And they are pleading to faith leaders to come outside of the walls of the church and to engage young people where they are. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a need for and an urge for young faith leaders to come out and support young people.
Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't forget to remind the audience that on October 20th, Black Women for Positive Change and Moms Demand Action are also collaborating on an impacted by violence panel discussion.
And where is that? We have October 20th.
That's going to be at St. James Church, 11524 Frankstown Road in Penn Hills. And we are doing that in cooperation with Ceasefire Pennsylvania and Jamar's Place of Peace.
Okay, we have just a few minutes left, and I want to talk a little bit about partnerships. And Diane, you alluded to it a little bit before about schools and getting schools and students involved. Is this an overall effort to touch the lives of students before they might get involved in violence, even if maybe their families have been the victims of or they know somebody, but get them involved in a positive way so that they don't become involved in a life of violence.
You are absolutely correct. The earlier you're able to engage and inform young people, the greater the chance that they will grow up to be nonviolent. And really, we're just trying to promote concepts about nonviolence, conflict resolution, and alternatives so that they are able to mediate conflict without having resort to picking up a gun or hitting someone.
Right. Mickey, I wanted to ask you, moms, the moms group, how do they work with families that are to sort of, try to avoid the violence who are already touched by it to help them? What is the role? Yeah.
I think it's important to recognize that gun violence kind of plays out or manifests differently in different communities. So the focus of mom, I think we should recognize that of the approximately 90 people per day in this country who die from being shot by a gun, over half is suicide, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, if you look at that statistic and you say, is there a way that we can store guns where people have to think about, especially young people, have to think about it before they go get a gun and shoot themselves. So that's one thing that we do. And another is through our Be Smart program, we help parents recognize that they need their gun, they are gun owners, and they need to store their guns safely. If their children are going to someone else's home, we need to be asking questions about how guns are stored in the home.
Right. And there are proposals to require safer storage in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is not a state that penalizes parents for if minors get a hold of those guns and commit violent acts. Very briefly, 2 minutes. Your efforts are not a week with nonviolence. Your efforts are year-round. Give us just a little sense of what you do.
Well, throughout the year, we have hosted workshops in collaboration with local police forces to deal with issues of racial reconciliation and bias to improve community relationships. The Pittsburgh police have been very proactive in that sense. We've also worked closely with community organizations such as West End Power to help their residents. Some young moms who have lost children to violence are kind of demystified by the legal process, don't know how to get their questions answered, or are uncertain about the investigation status of a homicide. And so we helped open the door get them in contact with detectives and the district attorney's office.
And the final 30 seconds go to you, Mickey.
Yes, we need to elect people who are gun sense candidates. So mm-hmm. our focus over the last couple of weeks is getting people to be gun sense voters. And you can go online, actually, and type in your address and find out who is a gun sense candidate in your district.
All right. Mickey McDonough is with Moms Demand Action. Diane Powell is president of Black Women for Positive Change, Pittsburgh chapter, which is hosting the 6th annual Week of Nonviolence starting this Sunday. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, we often hear about major grants being awarded to researchers in various scientific fields. We're going to hear about the risk-reward economics of research. Plus, the co-directors of the Carnegie Science Center are getting ready to retire. What will that mean for the future of the Science Center? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.